Welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. This is where we will tell you about the best books, movies, and music to check out or download.
Also, fun events at the library like concerts, author talks, other special events that are happening in town here.
I think you covered it, Amanda. Okay. That was pretty good.
Awesome.
This is the June's version of the podcast. And as some of you might know, June is the 10th anniversary of the main library, or at least the main library building, and there's going to be a lot of awesome events here at the library in June. But two that relate to popular materials are an Annie Selleck concert. That is Saturday, June 25th at 2:30 at the main library auditorium. And then also Ann Patchett will be here June 28th at 6:15 p.m., and she'll be talking about her new book, State of Wonder. And, you know, when Ann Patchett writes a new novel, it is a big deal in the literary world and an even bigger deal here at the library. So Ann Patchett, well, she'll books for sale, too. People always ask that. Will there be books for sale? Yes, you can buy a book. I have to be honest, I don't know if Annie Selleck will be selling CDs, but why not?
She's got to be.
You got to be.
Yeah, she's got to be.
Come on, Annie Selleck, sell some CDs. And because this is the Popular Materials podcast, again, half the crew today does not work in Popular Materials. So this is the abbreviated crew today. So I'm here. I'm Brian, and
I'm Amanda. I'm here with you as well, representing the Popular Materials.
And
Lisa from the Young Adult Teen section.
And
Jesse representing the Reference Desk.
All right, we're going to start first with books. For the last 10 years, that's a lot of pages, a lot of words. Hard to pick the best of what you think is your favorite from those 10 years. I had trouble narrowing it down, but I'm going to start first with a series of books, all based on one character. They're called The Spellman Files by Lisa Lutz. She started in 2007 with the first book, The Spellman Files. She currently has four in the series that take a look at the family Spellman. The Spellmans run their own PI business and employs everyone in the family, conveniently. The series focuses, though, on Isabel Spellman and is written from her point of view. We also get to meet her perfect older brother, David, her sugar-addicted younger sister, Ray, that's R-A-E, Albert and Olivia, her parents, mom and dad, and a lovable Uncle Ray, that's R-A-Y, who is currently at war with younger sister, Ray, R-A-E. The non-Spellman team represents with Henry, a local cop and health food advocator, along with Izzy's best friend and hairstylist, Petra. My favorite parts of the Lutz books, though, are the footnotes that the author throws in, which apparently for some reason, if you download the ebook version, you lose. So check out the book version.
Lame. That's a total fail, right?
It really is.
The total ebook fail.
I was like, you can download them from her website, but it kind of loses a little bit. Check out the book from your library today. They're completely non-essential to the development of the plot, but a large portion of the humor would be missed if you skip the footnotes. So here they are in order for your reading pleasure, because why would you want to read them out of order? The first book is The Spellman Files, followed by Curse of the Spellmans, Revenge of the Spellmans, and The Spellmans Strike Again. Fun footnote, just if you're ever tailing someone, the Spellman family method is you bust out their back taillight. So then you can, you know, which car that you're trying to tail especially works well at night.
Good advice.
It's just safety tip right there for future
family reunions.
Yes. Lutz has said that this fourth book, Spellman Strike Again, was going to be the final book, but she received so much fan flack over it that she's now working on a fifth book that's probably not going to be out sometime until 2012, but we're just happy there's one coming, so there will be more Spellman fun. A lot of people have dubbed her, saying that her Spellman books are Nancy Drew after a bottle of Jack Daniels. I would classify them as unmissable, which I think is a word I totally just made up, which shows how good they are. And I want to thank Cheryl Carpenter for recommending the very first one for me back in the great, great year of 2007. Also, in addition, because I can't decide what I like more, nonfiction or fiction, a quick shout out for my favorite true story book from the last 10 years. It's To Reach the Clouds by Philippe Petit. He was that crazy guy who tightrope walked between the World Trade Center towers in 1974. In 2002, right after September 11th, this book came out. It was a really interesting look, inspiring look, at how obsessive and driven someone can be in pursuit of the dream. Petit actually decided he was going to do this years before he got a chance to try it. And the book kind of chronicles his steps going through that. In 2008, I don't think it was directly made from this book, but there was a movie made called Man on Wire about the same story, and some of the images from both the book and the movie are absolutely amazing. I'm not a big fan of heights, and so I wouldn't even be comfortable on the observation deck of the Twin Towers. And here he was out on the wire doing tricks and laying down and walking around for hours before they finally pulled him off the wire. I wouldn't want to do it, but I'm very happy to read about it, and you should be too. So, Lisa, what did you like to read in the last 10 years?
I had a lot of trouble figuring out something from this decade, but around the new year, I was reading a list of the best of the oddies, or the naughty oddies, and tried to work my way through a lot of the books that they suggested, and the best one out of those was called Pastoralia, which I tried to look up as a definition, and it mainly came up with web-based youth pastors. So it's not about that. It's actually the second book of short stories written by George Saunders. That's S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S. And it collects pieces that were originally published in the New Yorker magazine in the late 90s, but since its publication date was 2000, I think it still counts. There's one novella and four short stories, and it's just bone-dry wit, slightly askance worldview, dystopian stories about just the near future. Probably the most interesting story in it is the title story, which is about initially what seems to be a caveman, but turns out to be a paid reenactor working in a historically themed amusement park. And he's having trouble with his coworker, who's supposed to be his mate. They're supposed to only, like, talk in grunts and eat bugs off each other. And the whole idea is to live in the theme park, like, you know, 24 hours, 7 days a week, and it gets to be kind of difficult for both of them because they keep getting faxes, which I thought was strange that they went to, like, an outdated, even 2000 kind of mode of communication. They talk in faxes to the outside world, and his mate keeps getting faxes about her son, who was in rehab, but then is now in jail because he stole the TV from the rehab to buy drugs. So it's really interesting to see kind of, I guess, his view of people having, like, a sentimental journey back to olden times, because there's a frontier land, there's a Civil War land, there's a caveman land. Anyway, I like the way he writes, I like the way he thinks. So if you like kind of off the beaten track, I guess, fiction, George Saunders, he's your man.
I really enjoyed Civil War Land in Bad Decline that he wrote also, which I guess is about the Civil War land section of the amusement park being haunted by ghosts.
It was from slightly before that, so I couldn't put it in my 2000s. Yeah. And I had read this one first, so both of them are good, though.
I just think it'd be fun to live in an amusement park all the time.
Well, it's funny because they get fined, like, for not doing the right thing, and the only way they're really paid, other than to their family, is through food. So they're like, no goat today. Like, there'll be, like, a drop box where they're supposed to get a goat, and it's like, sorry, no goat today. We might make up with it for more goats tomorrow. And it's just, I don't know. It's really, like, kind of macabre funny, I guess. Jesse, what have you been reading in the 2000s that you would now like to share with us?
Fortunately, I've only read one book in the past 10 years.
And
that book was really good. It was Atmospheric Disturbances by Rivka Galchen. It's her debut novel, and it's pretty powerful for a debut novel. It's about a psychiatrist, I guess, who has one of his patients thinks that he is a secret agent who's trying to fight a group that controls the weather to change world events. And the psychiatrist ends up having his own sort of breakdown where he believes his wife is not actually his wife, that she's been replaced by her doppelganger. And he sort of goes on a journey to Argentina to find his real wife. And one of the interesting things about the book is that there's a sort of, like, it could be a science fiction book where everything's true and his wife really is a doppelganger and there really is a secret cobble controlling the weather, or he could just be losing his mind. And it's never, you know, it's pretty vague how that works in the book. So I kind of like that it's maybe a science fiction novel, maybe a psychological. It's not really a thriller in any way. Also, the author Rivka Galchen's father, I think it's Zivi Galchen, who is a real meteorologist, plays a large part in the book. The main character is in correspondence with the author's dead father. Which is it's a pretty interesting little postmodern thing that I really enjoyed. But it's a good book. What's your favorite book of the past 10 years, Brian?
Well, just two things. Like, I tried to get my book club to read Atmospheric Disturbances, and they didn't go for it. Because I'd be like, well, what's it about? I was like, well, it's about a psychiatrist who thinks his wife isn't really his wife. And they're just like, yeah.
That sold me right there.
It's a real thing, though. Like, when you think all the people around you have been replaced by doppelgangers.
Oh, you're robots.
Like us, yeah. None of us are.
We can talk about Battlestar Galactica later. But I'm kind of disappointed, too, that you didn't mention Roberto Bolaño, because I'm not going to talk about him.
It didn't occur to me while thinking of this, because the idea of choosing a favorite thing for 10 years is I'm too indecisive. You know, it's hard for me to pick what flavor of ice cream I want at Baskin-Robbins, much less the best book that I've written.
You lived
and
a
now
life.
That you said Roberto Bolaño, I will scratch Rivka Galchen because 2666 is way better.
Yeah, I
and Savage Detectives also maybe better than that.
From
like those two books. Yeah. You changed my mind.
So whatever that decade is called, right? It's I don't even know what it is because it's not even the decade from 2000 to 2010. It's the 10th year anniversary of the library we're talking about here. So it's 2001 to 2011. So it's just our own little spaced out weird decade. But that decade defined for me in books is Roberto Bolaño, at least English translations of his work, appearing on the scene, and nobody writes like him. It's just really good stuff. But I've said that so many times on this show that I'm going to talk about something else. something I have talked about before, too, but when I had to think back about things that were the best or made the most impact on me, what came to mind was Europe Central by William Vollmann. And that was his World War II historical novel set on the Eastern Front between Nazi Germany and Communist Russia. And it profiles different generals and artists. And recently we got this online reference question about, I like Leo Tolstoy. What literature would you recommend today? And I was just thinking to myself, I was like, well, if there's anything contemporary equivalent to War and Peace, it's definitely Europe Central. And it's packed with all these details about the war, but also it's this really big love story. Two, if you're not really into historical fiction or you're worried that it's going to be dry and boring, there's all these surreal passages, dream sequences and parts where the plot just totally takes off, which I think is about what happens to the characters' psyches under two really extreme ideologies. So it's a great, wonderful book, really not like anything I've read before. And it actually won the National Book Award in 2005, so it's right in the middle of our weird little decade. And I think, too, that he got that award for that book, even though that book was excellent, the best book of his I've ever read. But I think just in acknowledgement of his work, he's a very unique artist. His books always interweave his personal travels with journals and drawings of where he's been in the world and his vast historical knowledge of most continents on the earth. So it's just the idea that you are a really unique, interesting intellectual author that has emerged. And even though he started writing books in the 90s, I think his work really took off in the 2000s. He really matured as a novelist, his characters got better, that kind of thing. So even though Europe Central is this really huge, big book, he has another series called Seven Dreams, A Book of North American Landscapes, in which he tries to explain how North America went from nothing, dinosaurs, to now cities with asphalt everywhere. That's the stated goal. And then that's not even to mention his nonfiction, which I think he considers his actual work, even though he's written all these novels. Europe Central, for sure, for books.
He's an author that's always intimidated me. Just the idea of him makes my mind hurt. I've opened up a couple of his books and never gotten very far in any of them.
Oh, I can remember working at a different library whenever Europe Central came out. I just looked at the cover and it was just that's just some really kind of stuffy, boring, too thick footnote-induced nightmare by some old white man.
Yeah.
But then when I actually started reading his work, I realized that when he first started, he wrote a lot about homeless people and skinheads and prostitutes in San Francisco, and he was sort of associated as this punk novelist who was underground. And then only slowly, as I think his goals became more lofty and he became more formally accomplished, right? He got, for better or worse, accepted in the mainstream press and mainstream critics and academia and things like that as a really serious author. It's good stuff.
I should give it another try.
Well,
the ideas of it sound really interesting.
The thing that for me is he writes very long novels, and the shorter ones that I've read are not as good as the longer ones.
Yeah.
Just because I just think that kind of like Tolstoy, he has all these things to say. You know, his vision is total gestalt thing about the nature of a time period or the nature of a country. And if, you know, you're not going to invest that kind of time. I don't know. Right. But hey, it's best of the decade, not best of the last 10 seconds. So.
It probably took you a decade to read it because it's huge. So.
I would never have read this book, but I had to drive in a car for 2 days. So it was the audio book.
Nice.
There you go. 2 days, right? It's huge.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about our favorite music. For me, that decade in the 2000s is when noise broke, at least sort of broke or boiled to the surface, almost got popular, which is very strange for me because I was involved in noise music and I don't think there was ever a time before something that I was into that was sort of underground, sort of all started to be wrote about in the mainstream press and things like that. So, and we don't have any really truly harsh examples of noise in the library catalog, but we do have Black Dice. I think that's a pretty good compromise because I think that their work is pretty noisy, but it's also kind of poppy and there's song structure and you can listen to it. So Black Dice started as a really spasmodic hardcore band, but then slowly their work sort of evolved into experimental electronic music with no vocals. It's very chunky and propulsive, and the noises sort of build to crescendos, and then they kind of wash out. There's a singer, but he doesn't actually sing words. He just makes noises, and he manipulates the noises with pedals. So, and even though there's a guitar player too, he plays through a bank of effects pedals in that experimental noise music kind of way, but it's not riffs, you know, or individual notes. He makes sounds with his guitars, and then he manipulates the sound with the pedals. We have at least three of their records, and I think it's from their later phase in their career when they really evolved their sound into something really special, even though I think music geeks like Clint will probably disagree with me. I think that they're, for once, a noise artist actually evolved into more structured music, and it was good, which is not usually the case. For me, I want them to stay as harsh and as crazy as possible. Black Dice evolution was very pleasant in a good way. Psychedelically pleasant. Not pleasant the way orange juice is pleasant.
I hate orange juice.
So also, the graphic design on their work became very sophisticated, too. They were always interested in the visual arts and their collages that went into their covers of their records and flyers and everything you can get as art books and everything. This is the whole experience. They were really good, amazing artists. It's strange, though, too, even though I mentioned noise, they are, if you do the subject, search for the subject noise music in the catalog, they'll come up. But when I listen to it now, it's like, that just does not sound like noise music to me at all. It just sounds like instrumental electronic music, you know, maybe like some IDM. The way I kind of describe the Witch House stuff is being broken. If IDM was broken, I think it would probably be Black Dice. So, Black Dice for sure. I'm looking at Jesse, so he should probably go next. Yeah.
So, again, like with books, it's hard to pick a favorite over a 10-year span of time. But the thing that really stood out to me was Sound of Silver by LCD Sound System. They'd started out as a just very like dance electronica oriented band, and then this album, they took that electronica sort of thing and just became more mature with it in a way, I guess. They make electronic music the way a rock band makes rock music, if that makes sense to describe it that way. But it's, though it's this repetitive music, there's something organic about it, and it builds and moves in a really nice way. But there's a lot of emotion behind it and humor in it. Their songs are, they've got a song called New York, I Love You, But You're Letting Me Down, which is a, you know, sort of funny song about loving New York, but loving the New York of the past rather than the current New York City. The song that really spoke to me was the song Someone Great, which is, it's about sort of the feeling you get when you find out that someone you know has died. The record came out right about the same time that my grandmother died, and the song just really spoke to me in that way, and to be cheesy and sentimental and talk about things like that. But it was, you know, that's kind of an emotion that doesn't get expressed very often in music, I don't
not
think.
Not in dance music.
Not in dance music, especially, you know. But it's a really, like, poignant, it captures that idea, not just the idea of death, but, like, that death hitting you and becoming aware of it in a way where you're, like, you're busy dancing and partying all the time, and then you find out, you know, like, the world stops because you found out something like that. But it's got really good pop rock kind of songs on it, and then there's the like really long repetitive just techno dance songs, and but it's good. You should check it out.
I have to say that I'm not a big techno fan, but that album was as close as I've come to liking techno music. I mean, I listened to it more than once.
I don't really like techno music either, but yeah.
Everybody just trashes the album that they said was the best one. You know, I hate that kind of music.
Put it on record. I totally like techno. I'm trying to think what we have that's really good here. I've reviewed techno records that I like. Beyond the, like Chris Liebing, we have his records. They're really good. Speedy J.
What does it go under? Because, I mean, it's not like, would it be under pop? Or what would it be under?
Where the electronic music records are at in the library catalog is like, yeah.
It's magic.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So it depends what it is. Like, some of like Prefuse 73, which is not really unclassifiable music anyway, is like in pop section.
I guess most of it's probably in pop.
Yeah, so... But I'm trying to think, like, the Chris Liebling that I reviewed once on here, which is, like, super, like, hardcore. Right?
That's
and, like, that's in the rock. that's in the rock section. And most rock fans hate that.
Would not be listening.
Yeah, it would be like, what's this crap?
I think the LCD was in rock, too, if I remember. Rock. Yeah.
It's kind of black or white. There's no gray area in the...
But as long as it's not in country, we're all good.
Yeah. That's good. Okay, I said earlier that I've really had trouble finding things from the 2000s, and so it's probably not a surprise that for my music selection, I chose something that's kind of neo-retro soul, I guess. An album that probably everybody has already heard, but I think needs a second opinion, is Amy Winehouse's Back in Black, or Back to Black, Back in Black being the AC/DC song, which is not at all from the 2000s. I was thinking about different albums that came out in the 2000s, and I was really disappointed that she didn't end up making another one. That one, I think, came out in 2004. I looked it up earlier. I was listening to some covers that she'd done of different source material that she ended up using in her songwriting process, such as Monkey Man by Toots and the Maytals and Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles. And I think that her music is really in the same category with a lot of that stuff, and it's sad that she's more tabloid fodder these days. So my wish for the 2010s is that we get another Amy Winehouse record.
All right, I guess that brings it back to me to finish up. I, too, had a hard time, but when you think back to 2001, 10 whole years ago, I mean, music has changed so much since then. We were still, you know, blithely downloading from Napster, just, you know, hanging out buying CDs when they came out, you know, and now, 10 years later, we've got iTunes, we're downloading from Freegal, we've got, you know, single song downloads have really solidified into a, you know, a viable format that's not just, you know, ripped off somebody's computer in their basement. So I had to decide if I wanted to pick an album or just pick a bunch of songs. So I compromised with myself, and I picked one of my favorite songs from an album of other really good songs. One of the Frus from Frou Frou, Imogen Heap, released her first single album, Speak for Yourself, in 2005. The first single is my favorite track, called Hide and Seek. It's kind of a Laurie Anderson-esque electronic solo vocal track that she produced by using a harmonizer, which kind of gives her voice this electronic robot-y type sounding voices. But with the irregular rhythms, Hide and Seek kind of walks that line between traditional pop song and more of a spoken word piece. The song first really went big after they played it on the OC, so that was exciting. And then it was certified gold in April of 2009. My favorite part of the song, after Heap's original version that is really interesting to listen to, there's actually a couple versions that were arranged for marching band that they have been performed, and they've put their videos up on YouTube. So check out this album and then check those out. Just for FYI-ness, I also like the songs Goodnight and Go and Headlock, in case you were wondering. So that was music from the last 10 years.
You just made up the word FYI-ness, too.
I am the word queen today.
I like that one.
Make it up as I need it.
So I've never listened to Imogen Heap before, but I read about her a lot. So sell me. 30 seconds.
She is... You kind of like her because she's got a little bit of that noise element into, like, it's like underneath the music. They're still pretty traditional pop songs. She's English. They're very well written lyrics, but she's got like that edge on it that she plays with it. The rhythms are funky. They're not just 4/4 meters straight through. She kind of fits it to the text. So there's actually a little bit more brain behind it than just, look, I've got 3 chords and here's some songs that are mushy and about love. So.
Excellent. If someone would have put me on the spot like that, I would have had a heart attack. You just heard a popping noise. It was my left ventricle.
So I'm glad we didn't lose that.
You acquitted yourself admirably.
So, on to movies. Talking about our favorite movies that were we watched between 2001 and 2011. Mine would have to be The Squid and the Whale, directed by Noah Baumbach, the movie that first brought Jesse Eisenberg to public attention, maybe. It's about Noah Baumbach's family coming apart in the 70s, his parents getting divorced. The father is played by Jeff Daniels, is a novelist and professor. Mother is a film critic. And then how the divorce and the splitting part of the family affects the two children in such strange ways as Jesse Eisenberg playing the Noah Baumbach stand-in pretends that he wrote a Pink Floyd song, Hey You, the Pink Floyd song, performs it at a school talent show, and wins. And I've talked about Noah Baumbach on the podcast before because I like a lot of his movies, and this one also. You know, and I don't need to talk about it too much because I think most people have seen it. It got a lot of acclaim. But that was probably my favorite thing in the past 10 years.
I was thinking about movies from the 2000s, as we all were, and I came up with the movie. It's actually a documentary about the life of Robert Evans, and it's called The Kid Stays in the Picture. A lot of times when they try to make a documentary biographical film where the person that is the subject of the film is involved in it in any way, like I was thinking there was a Joan Rivers one that came out not that long ago. That one's pretty decent, but for the most part, the genre is just like undercut by the people in it being super egotistical, you know, making out, you know, their past to be something it wasn't. But what was so interesting in The Kid Stays in the Picture is Robert Evans, who was a film producer at Paramount Pictures throughout the 70s, really did have this just amazing larger-than-life story. And he narrates it himself. The narration is actually taken from an audiobook he did of his autobiography, put it all together with these just really neat montages of pictures from his life that kind of move in a 3D way. And it's really interesting to hear Robert Evans himself talking about being at the helm of Paramount when movies like Rosemary's Baby, True Grit, Love Story, The Godfather, The Great Gatsby, all these things kind of coming to the screen, and being friends with people like Jack Nicholson, his marriage getting broken up by Steve McQueen. Lots of really, really interesting things. My favorite part of the entire movie was a scene towards the end. They made a film for his birthday that was just Dustin Hoffman, who was on the set of one of the movies that he produced called Marathon Man, just making fun of him, like, for 10 minutes. He has a very inimitable, well, I guess imitable by Dustin Hoffman, but inimitable by me, way of talking that's really fast and really just kind of cocaine-fueled. But it was neat to see somebody that famous people talking about him, not him talking about famous people. And I liked the movie a lot.
Well, I'm going to lighten things up a little bit because I don't like really big, heavy films like apparently everyone else I work with. So if you stretch your mind all the way back, go all the way back to 2001, you may remember a small chick flick starring local sweetheart Reese Witherspoon in called Legally Blonde. The premise is that, like, this, like, super smart sorority girl named Elle Woods, along with her dog Bruiser Woods, like, decides to go to Harvard Law School to hopefully win back her ex, who dumps her because she's, like, really more of a Marilyn than a Jackie, and if he's gonna be a senator by the time he's 30, he needs a Jackie. Okay, sounds kind of vapid and mind-numbing, I'll give you, but there is a surprising amount of heart in this movie. Plus, where else can you learn how to do the patented bend and snap? Legally Blonde is really the first film that kind of catapulted Reese Witherspoon onto the A-list. Before that, she was just kind of doing bit parts. My favorite casting from the movie is actually Elle's father, who was played by James Reed, who was also in the North and South miniseries, which may sound unrelated, but I kind of watched them at the same time. So that's linked in my brain as, he's that guy from North and South. Check out Legally Blonde. I also want to give honorable mention to 2003, Something's Gotta Give, partially because of Diane Keaton in her role of a romantically repressed playwright, but mostly because of director-writer Nancy Myers, who I will watch anything that she does, even if it stars Alec Baldwin. yeah. Myers has done other things. She did The Parent Trap with the then-sane Lindsay Lohan. She did The Holiday with Jack Black and Kate Winslet and Cameron Diaz and Jude Law. And then her latest film was It's Complicated, is the one I don't really want to talk about because it had Alec Baldwin in it. Usually she writes and directs both, which makes it extra exciting. And Something's Gotta Give is gotta be my favorite of her films. Also, because I haven't talked enough yet today, I wanted to talk about a little bit of TV on DVD, because for those of you who haven't noticed, going to the movies has gotten expensive. So it's nice that you can just stay at home and watch TV either live or on DVD. My favorite channel to watch is USA because they show Burn Notice, which is why I wanted to talk to you about it today, because apparently I haven't talked enough about spies as well. Burn Notice stars Jeffrey Donovan as Michael Weston, a Burn spy who is trying to get his job back and not die in the process. So far, we've gone through 4 seasons, 3 of which we have at the library, and I'm looking forward to June 23rd when season 5 will come back on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock, because not enough stuff in my life blows up when Michael Weston's on vacation. Brian, what are you watching? The movies.
I just want to say that I watch any movie with Jude Law in it, even if all the rest of the characters are clones of Alec Baldwin.
I'm going to start working on my pro-Alec Baldwin rebuttal for next month.
Here's my pro-Alec Baldwin rebuttal would just be that he's really good in 30 Rock.
I don't like 30 Rock because of him.
Because he's playing himself.
Okay. I don't need that, though. I
respectfully tender my resignation from the podcast on Alec Baldwin-related grounds.
You were a few weeks ago, you were on like an Alec Baldwin kick, right?
Oh, yeah. I watched The Shadow.
The Shadow,
is one of the worst movies ever made, ever.
Saw it in a theater.
It's god-awful. I'm a huge fan of The Radio Show, and I was like, Alec Baldwin's in this. Why did it just drop off the theaters? It was like in the theaters for like 5 minutes, even though it had like Burger King tie-ins. And then, I guess it was because people hate Alec Baldwin for no reason.
Oh, I was going to say, so what should I watch to redeem Alec Baldwin?
Glengarry Glen Ross, fantastic. For like 15 minutes, but his 15
about
minutes...
That's as much Alec Baldwin as I could take.
It's a movie that's got Jack Lemmon, 3 or 4 other, like, Kevin Spacey's in it, and anything anybody remembers from it is his, like, tour de force performance in the middle of it. Or any of his stuff inside the actor's studio. If you can stand through his, hubris, he's really good at showing how it works, how to act. Like, he does this whole kind of questions from the audience thing that's just really amazing. This is my open letter to Alec Baldwin in 81.
I've seen parts of it. I've never seen all the way through.
Yeah.
He's one of the ghosts.
Okay, that's the one. I'll have to watch Beetlejuice because that's the one I could sit through.
Which I haven't seen in 20 years.
I got to say, too. Beetlejuice, one of my favorite Tim Burton films, totally doesn't hold up. Okay? Even though it's still one of my favorites. Good Alec Baldwin, right, even though this isn't really a TV show, are the extras on the Gary Shandling DVDs. Have you seen these?
That.
Oh, it's and you know what? I don't think the library has this, so I'm going to apologize. The best of the Gary Shandling show, there are these DVDs, right? One of the extras is Gary Shandling interviewing his celebrity friends, and one of them is Alec Baldwin, and instead of just interviewing him like normal, they box because Shandling's into boxing, and in the middle of the sparring match, Shandling brings up Alec Baldwin's divorce. So I just want to say...
Okay, that might be worth watching.
Not a good idea. Not a good idea, right?
He wrote a whole book about it.
Like,
It has to do with nothing else. Nothing else in his life, not his acting, not his career. It's all about the divorce. It's that important.
Yeah, it's just like... I think, you know, Shanley's just like suicidal, right? What's the deal, man? Like, of course, it's not a good...
Don't poke a bear with a stick.
Exactly. Like, it might have been staged, right? Like, I'm going to invite him over, get him, then just so people see, you know.
Be continued next month. So, when I get my written statement
into things that the library doesn't own, I'm going to break the rules again, which made Jesse so mad that he left, if you're wondering where he went, right? So I wanted to talk about a movie that doesn't even have a distributor yet, but I saw it at the Belcourt, and when it comes out on DVD, I will make sure that the library gets it. That's my promise to you. And the name of the film is Letters from the Big Man, which is a terrible name for such a good movie. So it's directed by Christopher Monk, and it's about a ecologist who, after a bad relationship, we don't really learn what, she goes to live in the forest to complete this report, and it's set in the wilderness of Oregon after a forest fire, and she is befriended by a Sasquatch. Okay? And at first it was like, oh man, this guy was such an art director, and I had these weird, like, Ang Lee's Hulk, you know what I mean, vibes going, like, I'm afraid of this. But it was this special event, and he was actually going to be there at the Belcourt, and it was totally packed, and the movie was awesome. And it's a meditation about humans and nature and animals, how we relate to humans, and also about logging in communities where logging takes place and the debate between environmentalists and loggers in communities, and it's really fair and honest in that way. Brilliant and subtle, And the lead character, played by Lily Rabe, is just this strong female character who gets befriended from the Sasquatch. And the title has to do with the fact that the Sasquatch talks to humans that they trust or appreciate, or the humans that they pick through, like, sub-vocal sounds. So she gets these letters from the Sasquatch. And what's great is, before you learn this, and this is a spoiler, so just
skip over this.
Like, sometimes, like, spoilers on audio podcasts are really stupid, right? but there's all these sounds in the soundtrack that are, like, really amazing that maybe you wouldn't even get it if you had, like, a cheap TV, right? But it's like, what is that? And then you realize that in all those scenes where there's weird sounds, that were scenes where a Sasquatch was off camera. So, it was just a really great movie, and the house was packed, and it's always good to see a film in a packed theater, but everyone that was there who grew up in communities where logging was an issue was just so personally touched by this film, including myself. It was just amazing. So watch for when Letters from the Big Man comes to theaters near you. It'll probably come to the Belcourt again, and then shortly after that, it will come out on DVD, and we'll have it here at the library.
Hear, hear.
Yay!
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Pop-Matic podcast. For more information, please visit www.library.nashville.org.
That's on the interwebs.